were hurrying back to Mrs. Barber's room, and the memory of Mrs. Barber's joy at the news.
"You tell her," Kitsy had said. "She'll be extra happy if she hears it from you."
Was a moment I played and replayed and never tired of. Her startled eyes, then delight blooming unguarded on her cool, tired face. One hand held to me and the other to Kitsy. But that beautiful smile, I would never forget it, had been all for me. Who knew it was in my power to make anyone so happy, or that I could ever be so happy myself? My moods were a slingshot. After being locked down and anesthetized for many years, my heart was zinging and slamming itself around like a bee under a glass, everything bright, sharp, confusing, wrong. But it was a clean pain, as opposed to the dull misery that had plagued me for years under the drugs like a rotten tooth, the sick, dirty ache of something spoiled. The clarity was exhilarating. It was as if I'd removed a pair of smudged-up glasses that fuzzed everything I saw. All summer long I had been practically delirious, tingling, daffy, energized, running on gin and shrimp cocktail and the invigorating whack of tennis balls, and all I could think was, Kitsy, Kitsy, Kitsy. And 4 months had passed, and it was December, brisk mornings and a chime of Christmas in the air, and Kitsy and I were engaged to be married, and how lucky was I! But though it was all too perfect, hearts and flowers, the end of a musical comedy, I felt sick. For unknown reasons, the gust of energy that had swept me up and fizzed me around all summer had dropped me hard, mid-October, into a drizzle of sadness that stretched endlessly in every direction. With a very few exceptions, Kitsy, Hobie, Mrs. Barber, I hated being around people, couldn't pay attention to what anyone was saying, couldn't talk to clients, couldn't tag my pieces, couldn't ride the subway. All human activity seemed pointless, incomprehensible, some blackly swarming anthill in the wilderness. There was not a squeak of light anywhere I looked. The antidepressants I'd been dutifully swallowing for 8 weeks hadn't helped a bit, nor had the ones before that. But then, I'd tried them all. Apparently, I was among the 20% of unfortunates who didn't get the daisy fields and the butterflies, but the severe headaches and the suicidal thoughts. And though the darkness sometimes lifted just enough so I could construe my surroundings, familiar shapes solidifying like bedroom furniture at dawn, my relief was never more than temporary, because somehow the full morning never came. Things always went black before I could orient myself, and there I was again with ink poured in my eyes, guttering around in the dark. Just why I felt so lost, I didn't know. I wasn't over Pippa, and I knew it. Might never be over her. And that was just something I was going to have to live with. The sadness of loving someone I couldn't have. But I also knew my more immediate difficulty was in rising to, what I found anyway, an uncomfortably escalating social pace. No longer did Kitsy and I enjoy so many of our restorative evenings à deux, the two of us holding hands on the same side of a dark restaurant booth. Instead, almost every night it was dinner parties and busy restaurant tables with her friends, strenuous occasions where, jumpy, unopiated, racked to the last synapse, it was hard for me to make the proper show of social ardor, particularly when I was tired after work. And then, too, the wedding preparations, an avalanche of trivia, in which I was expected to interest myself as enthusiastically as she, bright tissue paper flurries of brochures and merchandise. For her, it amounted to a full-time job, visiting stationers and florists, researching caterers and vendors, amassing fabric swatches and boxes of petit four and cake samples, fretting and repeatedly asking me to help her choose between virtually identical shades of ivory and lavender on a color chart, coordinating a series of girly-girl sleepovers with her bridesmaids and a boys' weekend for me. Organized by plait, at least I could count on staying drunk. And then the honeymoon plans, stacks of glossy booklets, Fiji or Nantucket, Mykonos or Capri. Fantastic, I kept saying, in my affable new talking-to-Kitsy voice. It all looks great. Although given her family and its history with water, It did seem odd that she wasn't interested in Vienna or Paris or Prague or any destination, actually, that wasn't a literal island in the middle of a freaking ocean. Still, I'd never felt so sure of the future, and when I reminded myself of the rightness of my course, as I often had occasion to do, my thoughts were not only to Kitsy but also Mrs. Barber, whose happiness made me feel reassured and nourished in channels of my heart which had stood scraped dry for years. Our news had visibly brightened and straightened her. She'd been stirring about the apartment. She'd pinked up with just the tiniest bit of lipstick, and even her most commonplace interactions with me were colored with a steady, stable, peaceful light that enlarged the space around us and beamed calmly into all my darkest corners.
"I never thought I'd be quite so happy ever again," she'd confided quietly one night at a dinner when Kitsy had jumped up very suddenly and run out to get the telephone, as she was apt to do, and it was just the two of us at the card table in her room, poking awkwardly at our asparagus spears and our salmon steaks.
"Because you were always so good to Andy, bolstering him, improving his confidence. He was absolutely his best self with you, always. And I'm so glad you're going to be an official part of the family, that we're going to make it legal now, because, oh, I suppose I shouldn't say this. I hope you don't mind if I speak from the heart for a moment. But I always did think of you as one of my very own. Did you know that? Even when you were a little boy."
This remark so shocked and touched me that I reacted clumsily, stammering in discomposure, so that she took pity and turned the conversation into another channel. Yet every time I remembered it, I was suffused with a glow of warmth. An equally gratifying, if ignoble, memory was Pippa's slight, shocked pause when I'd broken the news to her on the phone. Over and over again I had played that pause in my mind, relishing it, her stunned silence.
"Oh?"
And then, recovering,
"Oh, Theo, how wonderful. I can't wait to meet her."
"Oh, she's amazing," I'd said venomously. "I've been in love with her ever since we were kids." Which, in all sorts of ways I was still coming to realize, was absolutely true. The interplay of past and present was wildly erotic. I drew endless delight from the memory of 9-year-old Kitsy's contempt for geeky 13-year-old me, rolling her eyes, pouting when she had to sit by me at dinner. And I relished even more the undisguised shock of people who'd known us as children. "You? And Kitsy Barber? Really? Her?" I loved the fun and wickedness of it. The sheer improbability, slipping into her room after her mother was asleep, same room she'd shut against me when we were kids, same pink toile wallpaper, unchanged since the days of Andy, hand-lettered signs, "Keep out, do not disturb," me backing her in, Kitsy locking the door behind us, putting her finger to my mouth, tracing it across my lips, that first delicious tumble to her bed, "Mommy's sleeping, shh." Every day I had multiple occasions to remind myself how lucky I was. Kitsy was never tired. Kitsy was never unhappy. She was appealing, enthusiastic, affectionate. She was beautiful, with a luminous, sugar-white quality that turned heads on the street. I admired how gregarious she was, how engaged with the world, how amusing and spontaneous. "Little Featherhead," as Hobie called her, with a great deal of tenderness. What a breath of fresh air she was. Everyone loved her. And for all her infectious lightness of heart, I knew it was an extremely petty cavil, that Kitsy never seemed particularly moved by anything. Even dear old Carol Lombard had got teary-eyed about ex-boyfriends and abused pets on the news, and the closing of certain old-school bars in Chicago, where she was from. But nothing ever seemed to strike Kitsy as particularly urgent or emotional or even surprising. In this, she resembled her mother and brother, and yet Mrs. Barber's restraint and Andy's were somehow very different from Kitsy's way of making a flippant or trivializing comment whenever anyone brought up something serious.
"No fun,"
I'd heard her say with a half-whimsical sigh, wrinkling her nose when people inquired about her mother. Then, too, I felt morbid and sick even thinking it.
I kept watching for some evidence of sorrow about Andy and her dad, and it was starting to disturb me that I hadn't seen it. Hadn't their deaths affected her at all? Weren't we supposed to at least talk about it at some point? On one level, I admired her bravery. Chin up, carrying on in the face of tragedy or whatever. Maybe she was just really, really guarded, really locked down, putting up a masterly front. But those sparkling blue shallows, so enticing at first glance, had not yet graded off into depths, so that sometimes I got the disconcerting sensation of wading around in knee-high waters, hoping to step into a drop-off, a place deep enough to swim. Kitsy was tapping my wrist.
What? Barney's. I mean, since we're here, maybe we should take a spin round the homes department? I know Mother won't love it if we register here, but it might be fun to go for something a little less traditional for every day.
No, reaching for my glass, knocking the rest of it back. I really need to get downtown, if that's all right. Supposed to meet a client.
Will you be coming uptown tonight?
Kitsy shared an apartment in the East 70s with two roommates, not far from the office of the arts organization where she worked.
Not sure. Might have to go to dinner. I'll get out of it if I can. Cocktails, please. Or an after-dinner drink, at least. Everyone will be so disappointed if you don't put in at least a tiny appearance. Charles and Bette.
I'll try. Promise. Don't forget those, I said, nodding at the earrings, which were still lying on the tablecloth.
Oh, no, of course not, she said guiltily, grabbing them up and throwing them into her handbag like a handful of loose change.
3. As we walked outside together into the Christmas crowds, I felt unsteady and sorrowful, and the ribbon-wrapped buildings, the glitter of windows only deepened the oppressive sadness. Dark winter skies, gray canyon of jewels and furs, and all the power and melancholy of wealth.
What was wrong with me?
I thought, as Kitsy and I crossed Madison Avenue, her pink Prada overcoat bobbing exuberantly in the throng. Why did I hold it against Kitsy that she didn't seem haunted over Andy and her dad, that she was getting on with her life? But, clasping Kitsy's elbow, rewarded by a radiant smile, I felt momentarily relieved again and distracted from my worries. It had been 8 months since I left Reeve in that Tribeca restaurant. No one had yet contacted me about any of the bad pieces I'd sold, though I was fully prepared to admit my mistake if they did. Inexperienced, new to the business, here's your money back, sir, accept my apologies. Nights, lying awake, I reassured myself that if things got ugly, at least I hadn't left much of a trail. I tried not to document the sales any more than I'd had to, and on the smaller pieces had offered a discount for cash. But still, it was only a matter of time. Once one client stepped forward, there would be an avalanche. And it would be bad enough if I wrecked Hobie's reputation, but the moment there were so many claims that I stopped being able to refund people's money, there would be lawsuits. Lawsuits in which Hobie, co-owner of the business, would be named. It would be hard to convince a court he hadn't known what I was doing, especially on some of the sales I'd made at the important Americana level, and, if it came down to it, I wasn't even sure that Hobie would speak up adequately in his own defense, if that meant leaving me out to hang alone. Granted, a lot of the people I'd sold to had so much money they didn't give a shit. But still, when would someone decide to look under the seats of those Hepplewhite dining chairs, for instance, and notice that they weren't all alike, that the grain was wrong, that the legs didn't match, or take a table to be independently evaluated and learn that the veneer was of a type not used or invented in the 1770s. Every day I wondered when and how the first fraud might surface. A letter from a lawyer, a phone call from the American Furniture Department at Sotheby's, a decorator or a collector charging in the store to confront me, Hobie coming downstairs. Listen, we've got a problem. Do you have a minute? If the marriage-wrecking knowledge of my liabilities surfaced before the wedding, I wasn't sure what would happen. It was more than I could bear to think of. The wedding might not go off at all. Yet, for Kitsy's sake, and her mother's, it seemed even more cruel if it surfaced after,
especially since the Barbers were not nearly so well off as they had been before Mr. Barber's death. There were cash flow problems. The money was tied up in trust. Mommy had had to reduce some of the employees to part-time hours and let the rest of them go. And Daddy, as Platt had confided when attempting to interest me in more antiques from the apartment, had gone a bit bonkers at the end and invested more than 50% of the portfolio in Vista Bank, a commercial banking monster for sentimental reasons. Mr. Barber's great-great-grandfather had been president of one of the historic founding banks in Massachusetts, long since stripped of its name after merging with Vista. Unfortunately, Vista Bank had ceased paying dividends and failed shortly before Mr. Barber's death. Hence, Mrs. Barber's drastically reduced support of the charities with which she had once been so generous. Hence, Kitsy's job. And Platt's editorial position at his tasteful little publishing house, as he'd often reminded me when in his cups, paid less than Mommy in the old days had paid her housekeeper. If things got bad, I was pretty sure Mrs. Barber would do what she could to help, and Kitsy, as my spouse, would be obligated to help whether she wanted to or not. But it was a dirty trick to play on them, especially since Hobie's lavish praise had convinced them all, Platt especially, concerned with the family's dwindling resources, that I was some kind of financial magician sweeping in to his sister's rescue. "You know how to make money," he'd said, bluntly, when he told me how thrilled they all were Kitsy was marrying me instead of some of the layabouts she'd been known to go around with. "She doesn't." But what worried me most of all was Lucius Reeve. Though I had never heard another peep from him about the chest on chest, I had begun in the summer to receive a series of troubling letters. Handwritten, unsigned, on blue-bordered correspondence cards printed at the top with his name in copperplate. Lucius Reeve.
"It is getting on for 3 months since I made what, by any standards, is a fair and sensible proposal. How do you conclude my offer is anything but reasonable?"
And, later,
"A further 8 weeks has passed. You can understand my dilemma. The frustration level rises."
And then, 3 weeks after that, a single line.
"Your silence is not acceptable."
I agonized over these letters, though I tried to block them from my mind. Whenever I remembered them, which was often and unpredictably mid-meal, fork halfway to my mouth, it was like being slapped awake from a dream. In vain, I tried to remind myself that Reeve's claims in the restaurant were wildly off base. To respond to him in any way was foolish. The only thing was to ignore him, like an aggressive panhandler on the street. But then two disturbing things had happened in rapid succession. I had come upstairs to ask Hobie if he wanted to go out for lunch.
"Sure, hang on," he said.
He was going through his mail at the sideboard, glasses perched upon the tip of his nose.
"Hmm,"
he said, flipping an envelope over to look at the front. He opened it and looked at the card, holding it out at arm's length to peer at it over the tops of his glasses, then bringing it closer.
"Look at this," he said.
He handed me the card.
"What's this about?"
The card, in Reeve's all-too-familiar writing, was only two sentences, no heading, no signature.
"At what point is this delay unreasonable? Can we not move forward on what I have proposed to your young partner? Since there is no benefit to either of you in continuing this stalemate?"
"Oh, God," I said, putting the card down on the table and looking away.
"For Pete's sake."
"What?"
"It's him, with the chest on chest."
"Oh, him,"
said Hobie. He adjusted his glasses, regarded me quietly.
"Did he ever cash that check?"
I ran a hand through my hair.
"No." "What's this proposal? What's he talking about?"
"Look," I went to the sink to get a glass of water, an old trick of my father's when he needed a moment to compose himself.
"I haven't wanted to bother you, but this guy's been a huge nuisance. I've started throwing away the letters without opening them. If you get another one, I suggest you toss it in the trash."
"What does he want?"
"Well," the faucet was noisy, I ran my glass. "Well," I turned, wiped my hand across my forehead.
"It's really nuts. I've written him a check for the piece, as I said, for more than he paid.
So what's the problem?
I took a swallow of my water. Unfortunately, he has something else in mind. He thinks we're running an assembly line down here, and he's trying to cut himself in on it. See, instead of cashing my check, he's got some elderly woman lined up, nurses 24 hours a day, and what he wants is for us to use her apartment to, Hobie's eyebrows went up.
Plant?
Right, I said, glad he'd been the one to say it. Planting was a racket whereby fakes or inferior antiques were placed in private homes, often homes belonging to the elderly, to be sold to vultures clustering at the deathbed, bottom feeders so eager to rip off the old lady in the oxygen tent that they didn't realize they were being ripped off themselves. When I tried to give his money back, this was his counter-proposal. We supply the pieces, 50-50 split. He's been harassing me ever since. Hobie looked blank.
That's absurd.
Yes, closing my eyes, pinching my nose. But he's very insistent. That's why I advise you to...
Who's this woman?
Woman, elderly relative, whatever.
What's her name?
I held the glass to my temple.
Don't know. Here, in the city?
I assume so. I didn't care for this avenue of inquiry. Anyway, just throw that thing in the trash. I'm sorry I didn't tell you earlier, but I really didn't want to worry you. He's gotta get tired of this if we ignore him. Hobie looked at the card, then at me.
I'm keeping this.
No, he said sharply when I tried to interrupt him.
This is more than enough to go to the police with if we have to. I don't care about the chest.
No, no, he said, raising a hand to hush me.
This won't do. You've tried to set it right, and he's trying to force you into something criminal. How long has this been going on?
Don't know. A couple months, I said, when he kept on looking at me.
Reeve.
He studied the card with furrowed brow.
I'll ask Moira.
Moira was Mrs. DeFreeze's first name.
You'll tell me if he writes again.
Of course. I could not even think what might happen if Mrs. DeFreeze happened to know Lucius Reeve, or know of him, but fortunately there had been no further word on that score. It seemed only the rankest luck that the letter to Hobie had been so ambiguous, but the menace behind it was plain. It was stupid to worry that Reeve would follow through on his threat of calling the law, since, I reminded myself of it again and again, his only chance of obtaining the painting for himself was to leave me at liberty to retrieve it. And yet, perversely, this only made me long even more to have the painting close to hand, to look at whenever I wanted. Though I knew it was impossible, still I thought of it. Everywhere I looked, every apartment that Kitsy and I went to see, I saw potential hiding places, high cupboards, fake fireplaces, wide rafters that could only be reached by very tall ladder, floorboards that might easily be prized up. At night I lay staring into the dark, fantasizing of a specially built fireproof cabinet where I could lock it away in safety or, even more absurdly, a secret climate-controlled Bluebeard closet, combination lock only. Mine, mine. Fear, idolatry, hoarding. The delight and terror of the fetishist. Fully conscious of my folly, I downloaded pictures of it to my computer and my phone so I could gloat upon the image in private. Brushstrokes rendered digitally, a scrap of 17th-century sunlight compressed into dots and pixels. But the purer the color, the richer the sense of impasto, the more I hungered for the thing itself, the irreplaceable, glorious, light-rinsed object. Dust-free environment, 24-hour security. Though I tried not to think of the Austrian man who had kept the woman locked in a basement for 20 years, unfortunately, it was the metaphor that came to mind. What if I died? Got hit by a bus? Might the ungainly package be mistaken for garbage and tossed into the incinerator? 3 or 4 times I'd made anonymous phone calls to the facility to reassure myself of what I already knew from obsessively visiting the website. Temperature and humidity guaranteed with an acceptable conservatorial range for artworks. Sometimes when I woke up,
The whole thing seemed like a dream, although soon enough I remembered it wasn't. But it was impossible to even think of going up there, with Reeve like a cat waiting for me to scurry across the floor. I had to sit tight. Unfortunately, the rent on the storage unit was due in 3 months, and what with everything else, I saw no point whatsoever in going up to pay it in person. The thing was just to have Grisha or one of the guys go in and pay it for me, in cash, which I was confident they would do, no questions asked. But then the second unfortunate thing had happened, because only a few days earlier Grisha had shocked me thoroughly by sidling up with a sideways tick of his head when I was alone in the shop and adding up my receipts at the end of the week and saying,
"Mazur, I need a sit-down."
"Oh, yeah?
You unlock?"
"What?" Between Yiddish and gutter Russian, jumbled through a slur of Brooklynese and slang picked up from rap songs, sometimes Grisha's idioms didn't make it into any kind of English I could understand. Grisha snorted through his nostrils.
"I don't think you understand me right, champ. I am asking, is everything square with you? With the laws?"
"Hang on," I said. I was in the middle of a column of figures, and then, looking up from the calculator, "Wait, what are you talking about?"
"You, my brother, not condemning or judging. I just need to know, all right?"
"Why? What happened?"
"Peoples are hanging around the shop, keeping an eye on. You know anything about it?"
"Who?" I glanced out the window. "What? When was this?"
"I wanted to ask you. Scared to drive out to Borough Park to meet with my cousin Genka for some business he got going. Afraid of getting these guys on me."
"On you?" I sat down. Grisha shrugged.
4-5 times now. Yesterday, getting out of my truck, I saw one of them hanging around out front again, but he slipped across the street. Jeans, older, very casual dressed. Genka, he don't know nothing about it, but he's freaked. Like, I say we got some stuff going. He told me to ask you what you knew about it. Never talks, just stands and waits. I am wondering if it is some of your business with the Schwarze,"
he said discreetly.
"Nope."
The Schwarze was Jerome. I hadn't seen him in months.
"Well then, I hate to break it to you, but I think he's maybe police is smelling around. Mike, he has noticed too. He thought it was because of his child supports, but the guy just hangs around and does nothing."
"How long has this been going on?"
"Who knows, but 1 month at least. Mike says longer."
"Next time, when you see him, will you point him out to me?"
"He might be private investigator."
"Why do you say that?"
"Because in some ways he looks more like ex-cop. Mike thinks this. Irish, they know from cops. Mike said he looked older, like police retired from the force, maybe?"
"Right," I said, thinking of the heavy-set guy I'd seen out my window. I'd spotted him 4 or 5 times subsequently, or someone who looked like him, lingering out front during business hours. Always when I was with Hobie or a customer, inconvenient to confront him. Although he was so innocuous-looking, hoodie and construction worker boots, I could hardly be sure. Once, it had scared me badly. I'd seen a guy who looked like him lingering out in front of the barber's building, but when I got a better look, I'd been sure I was wrong.
"He's been around for a while, but this..."
Grisha paused.
"Normally I would not say anything. Maybe he's nothing, but yesterday..."
"Well, what? Go on," I said when he massaged his neck and looked guiltily to the side.
"Another guy. Different. I'd seen him hanging about this shop before, outside. But yesterday he came in the shop to ask for you by your name, and I did not like the looks of him at all."
I sat back abruptly in my chair. I'd been wondering when Reeve would take it in his head to drop by in person.
"I did not talk to him. I was out,"
nodding.
"So, loading the truck. But I saw him go in. Kind of guy you notice. Nice dressed, but not like a client. You were at lunch, and Mike was in the shop by himself. Guy comes in, asks, Theodore Decker? Well, you're not in, Mike says so. Where is he? Lot of questions about you. Like, do you work here? Do you live here? How long? Where you are? All sorts.
Where was Hobie?
He didn't want Hobie. He wanted you. Then,
he drew a line on the desktop with his finger.
Out he comes. Walks around the shop. Looks here, looks there, looks all around. This, I see from where I am across the street. It looks strange. And Mike did not mention this visit to you because he said maybe it's nothing. Maybe something personal. Better keep out of it. But I saw him too, and thought you should know. Because, hey, game, recognize game. You get me?
What did he look like? I asked, and then, when Grisha did not reply, older fellow? Heavy? White hair? Grisha made an exasperated sound.
No.
Shaking his head with resolute firmness.
This was nobody's grandpappy.
What'd he look like, then?
He looked like a guy you would not want to get into a fight with, is what he looked like.
In the silence that followed, Grisha lit a cool and offered me one.
So what should I do, Mazhor?
Sorry?
Do me and Genka need to worry?
I don't think so. Right, I said, hitting a little awkwardly the triumphant palm that he held up for me to slap.
Okay, but will you do me a favor? Will you come and get me if you see either of them again?
Sure thing.
He paused, looking at me critically.
You sure me and Genka don't need to worry?
Well, I don't know what you're doing, do I? Grisha flipped a dirty handkerchief from his pocket and scrubbed his purpled nose with it.
I don't like this answer from you.
Well, be careful, whatever. Just in case.
Mazhor, I should say the same of you.
4. I had lied to Kitsy. I didn't have a thing to do. Outside Barney's, we kissed goodbye on the corner of 5th before she walked back to Tiffany's to look at the crystal. We hadn't even made it to the crystal. And I went to catch the 6. But instead of joining the stream of shoppers pouring down the stairs to the station, I felt so empty and distracted, so lost and tired and unwell. I stopped instead to look in at the dirty window of the Subway Inn, straight across from the loading dock at Bloomingdale's, a time warp straight out of the Lost Weekend, and unchanged since my father's drinking days. Outside, film noir neon. Inside, same grimy red walls, sticky tables, broken floor tiles, strong Clorox smell, and a concave bartender with a rag over his shoulder, pouring a drink for a bloodshot solitary at the bar. I remembered my mom and I losing my dad at Bloomingdale's once, and how, mysteriously to me at the time, she'd known to leave the store and walk straight across the street and find him here, throwing back $4 shots with a wheezy old teamster and a bandana-wearing senior who looked homeless. I'd stood waiting inside the doorway, overpowered by the waft of stale beer and fascinated by the warm, secretive dark of the place, the Twilight Zone glow of the jukebox, and the Buck Hunter arcade game blinking away in the depths.
Ah, the smell of old men and desperation, my mother had said wryly, wrinkling her nose as she exited the bar with her shopping bags and caught me by the hand.
A shot of Johnny Walker Black, for my dad. 2 shots, maybe. Why not? The dark recesses of the bar looked warm, comradely. That sentimental, boozy aura that made you forget for a moment who you were and how you'd ended up there. But at the last moment, staring in the door so the bartender glanced over at me, I turned away and kept walking. Lexington Avenue. Wettish wind. The afternoon was haunted and dank. I walked right by the stop on 51st Street, and the 42nd stop, and still I kept going to clear my head. Ash-white apartment blocks, hordes of people on the street, lighted Christmas trees sparkling high on penthouse balconies, and complacent Christmas music floating out of shops, and weaving in and out of crowds, I had a strange feeling of being already dead, of moving in a vaster sidewalk grayness than the street or even the city could encompass, my soul disconnected from my body,
and drifting among other souls in a mist somewhere between past and present. Walk, don't walk. Individual pedestrians floating up strangely isolated and lonely before my eye. Blank faces plugged into earbuds and staring straight ahead, lips moving silently. And the city noise dampened and deafened under crushing, granite-colored skies that muffled the noise from the street. Garbage and newsprint. Concrete and drizzle. A dirty winter grayness weighing like stone. I thought, having successfully escaped the bar, I might see a movie, that maybe the solitude of a movie theater would set me aright, some near-empty afternoon showing of a film ending its popular run. But when, lightheaded and sniffling with cold, I got to the theater on 2nd and 32nd, the French cop film I wanted to see had already started, and so had the mistaken identity thriller. All that remained were a host of holiday movies and intolerable romantic comedies, posters of bedraggled brides, battling bridesmaids, a dismayed dad in a Santa hat with two howling babies in his arms. The cabs were starting to go off duty. High above the street, in the dark afternoon, lights burned in lonely offices and apartment towers. Turning away, I continued to drift downtown, with no very clear idea where I was going or why, and as I walked, I had the oddly appealing sensation that I was undoing myself, unwinding myself thread by thread, rags and tatters falling away from me in the very act of crossing 32nd Street, and flowing along amongst the rush hour pedestrians, and rolling along from the next moment to the next. At the next theater, 10 or 12 blocks down, it was the same story. The CIA film had started, as had the well-reviewed biopic of a 1940s leading lady. The French cop movie didn't start for another hour and a half, and unless I wanted the psychopath film or the searing family drama, which I didn't, it was more brides and bachelor parties and Santa hats and Pixar. By the time I made it to the theater at 17th Street, I didn't stop at the box office at all, but kept walking. Somehow, mysteriously, in the process of crossing Union Square, swept along in a dark eddy that had hit me from nowhere, I'd arrived at the decision to call Jerome. There was a mystic joy in the idea, a saintly mortification. Would he even have farms on such short notice? Would I have to buy regular old street dope? I didn't care. I hadn't done drugs in months, but for whatever reason, an evening nodding and unconscious in my bedroom at Hobie's had begun to seem like a perfectly reasonable response to the holiday lights, the holiday crowds, the incessant Christmas bells with their morbid funeral note, Kitsy's candy pink notebook from Kate's Papery, with tabs reading, "My bridesmaids, my guests, my seating, my flowers, my vendors, my checklist, my catering." Stepping back quickly, the light had changed, I'd almost walked in front of a car. I reeled back and nearly slipped. There was no point dwelling upon my unreasoning horror of a large public wedding. Enclosed spaces, claustrophobia, sudden movements, phobic triggers everywhere. For some reason, the subway didn't bother me so much. It had more to do with crowded buildings, always expecting something to happen. The puff of smoke, the fast-running man at the crowd's margin. I couldn't even bear being in a movie theater if there were more than 10 or 15 people in it. I would turn around with my fully paid ticket and walk right out. And yet somehow this massive, jam-packed church ceremony was springing up around me like a flash mob. I would swallow a few Xanax and sweat my way through it. Then, too, I hoped that the escalating social roar which I'd been riding like a boat in a hurricane would slow post-wedding, since all I really wanted was to get back to the halcyon days of summer when I'd had Kitsy all to myself, dinners alone, watching movies in bed. The constant invitations and gatherings were wearing me down, brightly shifting whirlwinds of her friends, crowded evenings and hectic weekends that I weathered with my eyes squeezed shut and clutching on for dear life. Lindsay? No, Lolly? Sorry, and this is Frida? Hi, Frida, and Trev? Trav, nice to see you. Politely, I stood around their antique farm tables, drinking myself into a stupor as they chatted about their country houses, their co-op boards, their school districts, their gym routines. That's right. Seamless transition from breastfeeding, although we've had some big changes in the nap schedule lately. Our oldest just starting pre-K, and the fall color in Connecticut is stunning. Oh, yes, of course. We all have our annual trip with the girls, but you know these boys' trips we do twice a year out to Vail, down to the Caribbean. Last year we went fly fishing in Scotland, and we hit some really outstanding golf courses. But oh, that's right, Theo. You don't golf. You don't ski. You don't sail, do you? Sorry, afraid not. The group mind was such private jokes and amusement. Everyone clustered around vacation videos on the iPhone. But it was hard to imagine any of them going to a movie by themselves or eating alone at a bar. The affable sense of committee among the men, particularly, gave me the slight feeling of being interviewed for a job. And all these pregnant women?
Oh, Theo, isn't he adorable?
Kitsy unexpectedly thrusting a friend's newborn at me. Me in all sincere horror leaping back as if from a lighted match.
Oh, sometimes it takes us guys a while, said Race Goldfarb complacently, observing my discomfort, raising his voice above the infants wailing and tumbling in a nanny-supervised area of the living room. But let me tell you, Theo, when you hold that little one of your own in your arms for the first time, patting his wife's pregnant tummy, your heart just breaks a little. Because when I first saw little Blaine, sticky-faced, staggering around unattractively at his feet, and gazed into those big blue eyes, those beautiful baby blues, I was transformed. I was in love. It was like, hey, little buddy, you are here to teach me everything. And I'm telling you, at that first smile, I just melted into goo like we all do. Didn't I, Lauren?
Right, I said politely, going into the kitchen and pouring myself a huge vodka. My dad, too, had been wildly squeamish around pregnant women, had in fact been fired from a job for one too many ill-advised remarks. Those breeder cracks hadn't gone over too well at the office. And far from the conventional melting into goo wisdom, he'd never been able to stand kids or babies either, much less the whole doting parent scene, dumbly smiling women feeling up their own bellies, and guys with infants bound to their chests, would go outside to smoke or else skulk darkly at the margins looking like a drug pusher whenever he was forced to attend any sort of school event or kiddie party. Apparently, I'd inherited it from him, and who knew, maybe Grandpa Decker as well. This violent, procreative disgust buzzing loudly in my bloodstream. It felt inborn, wired in, genetic. Nodding the night away. The dark-throated bliss of it. No thanks, Hobie, already ate. Think I'll just head up to bed with my book. The things these people talked about, even the men. Just thinking about that night at the Goldfarbs made me want to be so wrecked I couldn't walk straight. As I approached Astor Place, African drum players, drunks arguing, clouds of incense from a street vendor, I felt my spirits lifting. My tolerance was sure to be way down, a cheering thought. Only one or two pills a week to get me through the very worst of the socializing, and only when I really, really needed them. In lieu of the farms, I'd been drinking too much, and that really wasn't working for me. With opiates, I was relaxed, I was tolerant, I was up for anything. I could stand pleasantly for hours in unbearable situations, listening to any old tiresome or ridiculous bullshit without wanting to go outside and shoot myself in the head. But I hadn't phoned Jerome in a long time, and when I ducked in the doorway of a skate shop, the call went straight to voicemail, a mechanical message that didn't sound like his. Has he changed his number? I thought, starting to worry after the second try. People like Jerome, it had happened with Jack before him, could drop off the map pretty suddenly even if you were in regular contact. Not knowing what to do, I started walking down St. Mark's toward Tompkins Square. All day, all night, you must be 21 to enter. Downtown, away from the high-rise press, the wind cut more bitterly, and yet the sky was more open, too. It was easier to breathe. Muscle guys walking paired pit bulls, inked-up Betty Page girls in wiggle dresses, stumble bums with drag-hemmed pants and jack-o'-lantern teeth and taped-up shoes. Outside the shops, racks of sunglasses and skull bracelets and multicolored transvestite wigs. There was a needle exchange somewhere, maybe more than one, but I wasn't sure where. Wall Street guys bought off the street all the time if you believed what people said, but I wasn't wise enough to know where to go or who to approach. And besides, who was going to sell to me? A stranger with horn-rimmed glasses and an uptown haircut, dressed for picking out wedding china with Kitsy. Unsettled heart. The fetishism of secrecy. These people understood, as I did, the back alleys of the soul, whispers and shadows, money slipping from hand to hand, the password, the code, the second self, all the hidden consolations that lifted life above the ordinary and made it worth living. Jerome, I stopped on the sidewalk outside a cheap sushi bar trying to get my bearings. Jerome had told me about a bar, red awning around St. Mark's, Avenue A maybe? He was always coming from there, or stopping off on his way to me. The bartender dealt from behind the counter to patrons who didn't mind paying double for not having to buy on the street. Jerome was always making deliveries to her. Her name, I remembered it even, Katrina. But every other storefront in the neighborhood seemed to be a bar. I walked up A and down First, ducked into the first bar I saw with an even vaguely red awning, liverish tan, but it might have been red once, and asked, "Does Katrina work here?" "Nope," said the scorched redhead at the bar, not even looking at me as she pulled her pint. Shopping cart ladies, asleep with their heads on bundles. Shop window of glitter Madonnas and Day of the Dead figures. Gray flocks of pigeons beating soundlessly.
"You know you're thinking about it," said a low voice in my ear.
I turned to find a ripe, heavy-set, broadly smiling black man with a gold tooth in front, pressing a card into my hand. Tattoos, body art, piercing. I laughed. Him too, a rich, full-body laugh, both of us sharing in the joke, and slipped the card in my pocket and walked on. But a moment later I was sorry I hadn't asked him where to find what I wanted. Even if he wouldn't tell me, he looked like he would know. Body piercing. Acupressure foot rub. We buy gold, we buy silver. Many pallid kids, and then, further down, all on her own, a wan, dreadlocked girl with a filthy puppy and a cardboard sign so worn I couldn't read it. I was reaching guiltily into my pockets for some money. The money clip Kitsy had given me was too tight. I was having a hard time getting the bills out. As I fumbled, I was aware of everyone looking at me, and then, "Hey!" I cried, stepping back as the dog snarled and lunged, snapping and catching the hem of my pants leg in its needle-like teeth. Everyone was laughing. The kids, a street vendor, a cook in a hairnet sitting on a stoop talking on a cell phone. Wrenching my pants leg loose, more laughter, I turned away and, to recover from my consternation, ducked into the next bar I saw, black awning with some red on it, and said to the bartender, "Does Katrina work here?" He stopped drying his glass.
"Katrina?"
"I'm a friend of Jerome's."
"Katrina? Not Katya, you mean?"
The guys at the bar, Eastern Europeans, had gone silent.
"Maybe, what's her last name?"
One leather jacket guy had lowered his chin and turned full on his stool to fix me with a Bela Lugosi stare. The bartender was eyeballing me steadily.
"This girl you want, what is it that you want with her?"
"Well, actually, I..."
"What color hair?"
Blonde? Or, actually..." Clearly from his expression, I was about to be thrown out, or worse. My eyes had lighted on the sawed-off Louisville slugger behind the bar. "My mistake. Forget it." I was out of the bar and well down the street when I heard a shout behind me.
"Potter!"
I froze, as I heard him shout it again. Then, in disbelief, I turned. And while I still stood unable to believe it, people streaming round us on either side, he laughed and barged forward to throw his arms around me.
"Boris!"
Pointed black eyebrows, merry black eyes. He was taller. Face hollower, long black coat,
Same old scar over his eye, plus a couple of new ones.
Wow.
And wow yourself.
He held me out at arm's length.
Ha! Look at you. Long time, no?
I was too stunned to speak.
What are you doing here?
And, I should ask,
stepping back to give me the once-over, then gesturing down the street as if it belonged to him.
What are you doing? To what do I owe this surprise?
What?
I stopped by your shop the other day,
throwing the hair out of his face,
to see you. That was you? Who else? How do you know where to find me?
I shook my head in disbelief.
You weren't looking for me?
Drawing back in surprise.
No? This is accident? Ships passing? Amazing. And why this white face on you?
What?
You look terrible.
Fuck you. He said, slinging his arm around my neck.
Potter, Potter. Such dark rings.
Tracing a fingertip under one eye.
Nice suit, though. And hey.
Releasing me, flicking me with thumb and forefinger on the temple.
Same glasses on the face? You never got them changed?
All I could do was shake my head.
What?
He held out his hands.
You don't blame me for being happy to see you.
I laughed. I didn't know where to start.
Why didn't you leave a number?
I said.
So you're not angry with me. Hate me forever.
Though he wasn't smiling, he was biting his lower lip in amusement.
You don't...
He jerked his head at the street.
You don't want to go fight me or something.
Hi there,
said a lean, steely-eyed woman, slim-hipped in black jeans, sliding forward to Boris's side rather suddenly in a manner that made me think she was his girlfriend or wife.
The famous Potter,
she said, extending a long white hand ringed to the knuckles in silver.
Pleasure. I've heard all about you.
She was slightly taller than him, with long, limp hair and a long, elegant, black-clad body like a python.
I'm Miriam.
Miriam? Hi. It's Theo, really.
I know.
Her hand in mine was cold. I noticed a blue pentagram tattooed on the inside of her wrist.
But Potter's how he speaks of you.
Speaks of me? Oh yeah, what'd he say? No one had called me Potter in years, but her soft voice had brought to mind a forgotten word from those old books, the language of snakes and dark wizards. Parcel tongue. Boris, who'd had his arm around my shoulder, had unhanded me when she'd approached as if a code had been spoken. A glance was exchanged, the heft of which I recognized instantly from our shoplifting days, when we had been able to say, let's go, or here he comes, without uttering a word. And Boris, seeming flustered, ran his hands through his hair and looked at me intently.
You'll be around?
He inquired, walking backward. Around where?
Around the neighborhood.
I can be.
I want to...
He stopped, brow furrowed, and looked over my head on the street.
I want to talk to you, but now...
He looked worried.
Not a good time. An hour, maybe?
Miriam, glancing at me, said something in Ukrainian. There was a brief exchange. Then Miriam slipped her arm through mine in a curiously intimate manner and started leading me down the street.
There. Go down that way. 4 or 5 blocks. There's a bar off 2nd. Old Polak place. He'll meet you.
5. Almost 3 hours later, I was still sitting in a red vinyl booth in the Polak bar, flashing Christmas lights, annoying mix of punk rock and Christmas polka music honking away on the jukebox, fed up from waiting and wondering if he was going to show or not, if maybe I should just go home. I didn't even have his information. It had all happened so fast. In the past, I'd Googled Boris for the hell of it, never a whisper. But then I'd never envisioned Boris as having any kind of a life that might be traceable online. He might have been anywhere, doing anything. Mopping a hospital floor, carrying a gun in some foreign jungle, picking up cigarette butts off the street.
It was getting toward the end of happy hour, a few students and artist types trickling in among the pot-bellied old Polish guys and grizzled 50-ish punks. I'd just finished my third vodka. They poured them big. It was foolish to order another one. I knew I should get something to eat, but I wasn't hungry, and my mood was turning bleaker and darker by the moment. To think that he'd blown me off after so many years was incredibly depressing. If I had to be philosophical, at least I'd been diverted from my dope mission. Hadn't OD'd, wasn't vomiting in some garbage can, hadn't been ripped off or run in for trying to buy from an undercover cop.
Potter.
There he was, sliding in across from me, slinging the hair from his face in a gesture that brought the past ringing back. I was just about to leave.
Sorry.
Same dirty, charming smile.
Had something to do. Didn't Miriam explain?
No, she didn't.
Well, it's not like I work in an accounting office.
Look, he said, leaning forward, palms on the table.
Don't be mad. Was not expecting to run into you. I came as quick as I could. Ran, practically.
He reached across with cupped hand and slapped me gently on the cheek.
My God, such a long time it is. Glad to see you. You're not glad to see me too?
He'd grown up to be good-looking. Even at his gawkiest and most pinched, he'd always had a likable shrewdness about him, lively eyes and a quick intelligence. But he'd lost that half-starved rawness, and everything else had come together the right way. His skin was weather-beaten, but his clothes fell well. His features were sharp and nervy, cavalry hero by way of concert pianist. And his tiny gray snaggle teeth, I saw, had been replaced by a standard-issue row of all-American whites. He saw me looking, flicked a showy incisor with his thumbnail.
New snaps.
I noticed.
Dentist in Sweden did it, said Boris, signaling for a waiter. Cost a fucking fortune. My wife kept after me. Borya, your mouth, disgraceful. I said, no way am I doing this. But was the best money I ever spent.
When'd you get married?
Huh?
You could have brought her if you wanted. He looked startled.
What, you mean Miriam? No, no.
Reaching into the pocket of his suit jacket, punching around on his telephone.
Miriam's not my wife. This,
he handed me the phone.
This is my wife. What are you drinking?
He said before turning to address the waiter in Polish. The photo on the iPhone was of a snow-topped chalet, and out in front, a beautiful blonde on skis. At her side, also on skis, were a pair of bundled-up little blonde kids of indeterminate sex. It didn't look so much like a snapshot as an ad for some healthful Swiss product like yogurt or Bircher muesli. I looked up at him, stunned. He glanced away with a Russianate gesture of old. Yeah, well, it is what it is.
Your wife? Seriously?
Yeah,
he said with a lifted eyebrow.
My kids, too. Twins.
Fuck.
Yes, he said regretfully. Born when I was very young. Too young. It wasn't a good time. She wanted to keep them. Borya, how could you?
What could I say? To be truthful, I don't know them so well. Actually, the little one. He is not in the picture. The little one I have not met at all.
I think he is only, what, 6 weeks old?
What? Again, I looked at the picture, struggling to reconcile this wholesome Nordic family with Boris. Are you divorced?
No, no, no.
The vodka had arrived. Icy carafe and two tiny glasses. He was pouring a shot for each of us.
Astrid and the children are mostly in Stockholm. Sometimes she comes to Aspen for the winter to ski. She was ski champion, qualified for the Olympics when she was 19.
Oh, yeah? I said, doing my best not to sound incredulous at this. The kids, as was fairly evident upon closer viewing, looked far too blonde and bonny to be even vaguely related to Boris.
Yes, yes, said Boris, very earnestly, with a vigorous nod of the head. She always has to be where there is skiing, and you know me, I hate the fucking snow. Her father very, very right-wing, and Nazi, basically. I think, no wonder Estrid has depression problems with father like him. What a hateful old shit. But they are very unhappy and miserable people, all of them, these Swedes. One